So, namaste, welcome. We're part of the way into the eighth chapter, Sankhya and Yoga. We have to take our time going through because there's lots of abstruse philosophy and historical data to wade our way through. So we remember first that Sankhya is a Sanskrit term that means enumeration, when you're counting things out. And so the analysis of nature that Sankhya as a philosophy offers is to look at the various modes of nature, of the components of reality, and to recognize what they are. So fundamentally, there are two: Purusha, conscious soul, and Prakriti, active nature. Purusha, Sankhya says, is inactive. The witness consciousness never really moves, but simply sees. Prakriti thinks it's conscious, but actually draws its apparent consciousness by reflection from Purusha. So there is a deep relationship between the two, much confusion that can result. And this dualistic school, we can say right at the outset, is not accepted per se by Sri Aurobindo, who is a monist, who has a depth of spiritual experience that unites the opposites and does not divide. So, nevertheless, all of Indian philosophy, from the earliest Upanishads all the way to this day, has dealt with this idea of the modes of nature in one way or the other. Whether it was through the school of Sankhya or not, the elements of Sankhya, as we noted, are present even in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the oldest of the Upanishads, and is current in today's lexicon. So we have a tradition then at least 3,000 years old, maybe farther back than that, in which we are working with these concepts. So, Purusha Prakriti, that's where we left off last time. We'll take it up from there. For Prakriti is constituted of three gunas, or essential modes of energy. Sattva, the seat of intelligence, conserves the workings of energy. Rajas, the seat of force and action, creates the workings of energy. Tamas, the seed of inertia and non-intelligence, the denial of sattva and rajas, dissolves what they create and conserve. Well, we have hints of this in the Gita, chapter 13, shloka 19, and also chapter 14, shloka 5. When these three powers of the energy of Prakriti are in a state of equilibrium, all is in rest. There is no movement, action, or creation, and there is, therefore, nothing to be reflected in the immutable, luminous being of the conscious soul. Chapter 14, you can say shlokas 22 through 25. But when the equilibrium is disturbed, then the three gunas fall into a state of inequality in which they strive with and act upon each other, and the whole inextricable business of ceaseless creation, conservation, and dissolution begins, unrolling the phenomena of the cosmos. Now, what we've just red here is not something that we see directly in the pages, in the shlokas of the Bhagavad Gita. That composition that we have takes a general recognition of what are the three gunas, what is the relationship of these gunas with Purusha, but does not enter into the detailed description of an emerging cosmology. This period from the Chandogya Upanishad, Brihadaranyaka, etc., all the way down to when the Gita was composed, when the Mahabharata itself was brought together, when some of the early Puranas were being pulled into some kind of condition of wholeness, is part of what we would call the proto-Sankhya period. And the strict definition of what are the evolutes from Mula Prakriti, from the root Prakriti, have not been posited yet. It would take several hundred years more before we would get that kind of description in philosophic form. So we will see the gunas make an appearance in various ways. Rich descriptions throughout the Gita, but not this philosophical acuity, which comes much later. So this proto-Sankhyan period would run from, say, 800 BCE up until 300 CE, Common Era. Then there's a pre-Karika period. The Karikas are the verses which describe what are the processes and constitutes of the system. This pre-Karika period would run from 100 BCE up to maybe 400 CE, where it would be meeting what we would see in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. So the sutras can't come into being until the Karikas have come into being. The Karikas themselves congeal and come into definition between 350 CE and maybe 800 CE. And we're able to say that now because of a number of discoveries that were made in the 20th century, which allows us to put together a better historical picture than we had. A lot of it is still guesswork. You can see by this vast expanse of time, we're talking about 1,000 years in some cases between the first formulations of these ideas, Purusha is this and Prakriti is that, and then all the 25 tattvas that are associated with the system. So when we come to Kashmir Shaivism, there are even more. But that again is 1,000 years even later than this earliest. So we have begun to unroll the phenomena of the cosmos. This continues so long as the Purusha consents to reflect the disturbance which obscures his eternal nature and attributes to it the nature of Prakriti. But when he withdraws his consent, the gunas fall into equilibrium and the soul returns to its eternal unchanging immobility. It is delivered from phenomena. This reflection and this giving or withdrawal of consent seem to be the only powers of Purusha. He is the witness of nature by virtue of reflection and the giver of the sanction, Sakshi and Anumanta of the Gita, but not actively the Ishvara. So Sakshi, witness, chapter 9, shloka 18, Anumanta, chapter 13, shloka 23. So the picture that you have then is that Prakriti sleeps undisturbed. Nothing is going on. Purusha looks at Prakriti, and Prakriti, reflecting the consciousness of the soul within itself, stirs into activity. So it's the gaze of the conscious soul upon sleeping Prakriti that stirs her into action, as if there's an audience finally, and so the dance begins. And all the three gunas come whirling into composition, sometimes cohesive, sometimes destructive, sometimes dynamic, but always interesting to the Purusha. Whatever may be going on, the Purusha doesn't take his eyes off that, or doesn't seem to. But is the Purusha ever really involved? Or is it simply the consciousness of the Purusha reflected in Prakriti that gives it consent and seeming permission to move? Ah, a philosophic problem which is not answered in the time of the Gita, except to say, quit looking at it and you will come to peace. When Purusha withdraws its attention, Prakriti comes to rest and the soul is free. Don't mistake this. It is our identification with the processes of nature which leads to ignorance, which leads to being engulfed by experiences. But if you know fully what you are, if you know that you are the conscious being, the Sakshi, that you have the power to will or not to will, Anumanta, then you can withhold your sanction, pull yourself within the power of your own consciousness, and be free from the demands and the complaints of Prakriti. So back to Sri Aurobindo. Even his giving of consent, so even Purusha's giving of consent is passive, and his withdrawing of consent is only another passivity. All action, subjective or objective, is foreign to the soul. It has neither an active will nor an active intelligence. It cannot, therefore, be the sole cause of the cosmos, and the affirmation of a second cause becomes necessary. Not soul alone, by its nature of conscious knowledge, will, and delight, is the cause of the universe, but soul and nature are the dual cause, a passive consciousness and an active energy. So the Sankhya explains the existence of the cosmos. Glad he added that last sentence, because he wouldn't want you to think that this is his view. It is not his view of cosmogenesis. But whence then come this conscious intelligence and conscious will, which we perceive to be so large a part of our being, and which we commonly and instinctively refer not to the Prakriti, but to the Purusha? According to the Sankhya, this intelligence and will are entirely a part of the mechanical energy of nature and are not properties of the soul. They are the principle of buddhi, one of the 24 tattvas, the 24 cosmic principles. Purusha is number 25. So buddhi is a word, you recognize it, Buddha, the enlightened one. So buddhi as a principle in the cosmos is the crown of cosmic manifestation. Buddhi is the pinnacle, also equated in some definitions of the system of Sankhya as being Mahat, the vast. So if there's a Mula Prakriti, an original matrix from which the gunas come, Then when first they stir, there is composed a vastness, this mahat, a consciousness or a seeming consciousness, which is at the apex, which has power of intelligence and force of will. Hence, Sri Aurobindo describes it, intelligence and will. And again, just to remind you of where we are in the historical context, the Gita does not go into depth about this, because this analysis that we're about to read from Sri Aurobindo comes from the Sankhya Karika period, say from 350 to 450 CE, and is aligned very much with the Yoga Sutras. We'll deal with this more later, if necessary. Prakriti and the evolution of the world bases herself with her three gunas in her as the original substance of things, unmanifest, inconscient, out of which are evolved successively five elemental conditions of energy or matter. For matter and force are the same in the Sankhya philosophy. These are called by the names of the five concrete elements of ancient thought, ether, air, fire, water, and earth, but it must be remembered that they are not elements in the modern scientific sense, but subtle conditions of material energy and nowhere to be found in their purity in the gross material world. So they exist inwardly. So these are in a sense projected out by the power of buddhi. They are evolutes of buddhi. All objects are created by the combination of these five subtle conditions or elements. This is going to get more complicated in a moment. Again, each of these five is the base of one of five subtle properties of energy or matter, sound, touch, form, taste, and smell, which constitute the way in which the mind sense perceives objects. Thus, by these five elements of matter put forth from primary energy, and these five sense relations through which matter is known, is evolved, what we would call in modern language the objective aspect of cosmic existence. So let's make this simple in terms of a cascading cosmology from above to the below. And I'm going to, this is cheating, because the next paragraph will say some of this to you, but you might be fully lost by then, so I'm going to go ahead and put it like this. So at the top, at the crown of creation, Mahas, Buddhi. And then from Buddhi, the sense of I, the I maker, Ahamkara, the ego maker. So Buddhi begins to think of itself. And then Buddhi begins to say, well, I need something to think about, and creates mind directly, which is, yes, one of the senses. And then all the subtle senses flow out from Manas, but subtly first, and then they concretize. But not just the senses can exist, but also the objects to which they would attach. So then are created subtle objects. And finally, at the bottom, are the gross objects. So the gross objects, the subtle objects. The gross senses, the subtle senses. Manas, which takes all the information gathered from this whirling cosmological picture and presents it to the buddhi to judge. The manas simply brings it together. It's not the mind at its highest station. But this is its role in the Sankhya. Buddhi has charge of the analysis, of the penetration, of the intuitive power to pull it into a full picture. And Buddhi stands at the peak. So you can see that this is an image, again, of the creation that begins above and proceeds below. So even here, in the material picture, because all of this is dealing with the matrix, material, mater, the mother, the matrix, prakriti, she who creates, begins above and installs everything below. Now the natural movement of prakriti with purusha watching is to deliver everything from the apparent inconscient and drive it upwards, because this being, whether it's really material or really conscious, can reach a pinnacle and in a clear mirror see reflected the reality of the watching spirit. So the best thing about prakriti is that at its highest, it releases its image and purusha recognizes itself instead of the mirror and says, ah. So let's go forward though. So that's the picture, top to bottom. 13 other principles constitute the subjective aspect of the cosmic energy. Buddhi or Mahat, Ahankara, Manas and its 10 sense functions, 5 of knowledge, 5 of action. Manas, mind, is the original sense which perceives all objects and reacts upon them, for it has at once an inferent to bring on or in, and an efferent activity, moving outwards, going away, receives by perception what the Gita calls the outward touches of things, bahya sparsha, and so forms its idea of the world and exercises its reactions of active vitality. Chapter 5, Shlokas 21 and 27. So, this picture of the cosmos, again, takes another 500 to 1,000 years to develop into a system which we can call the Sankhya Karikas. So this is not all of it spelled out in the Bhagavad Gita, but Sri Aurobindo is presenting it here because this is the common understanding of Sankhya. But it specializes its most ordinary functions of reception by aid of the 5 perceptive senses of hearing, touch, sight, taste, and smell, which make the 5 properties of things their respective objects, and specializes certain necessary vital functions of reaction by aid of the 5 active senses which operate for speech, locomotion, the seizing of things, ejection, and generation. So you see, anytime there's a psychological component, it has to develop forms outwards that it can contact. We don't see this subtle engineering in the universe. We see the reverse. We see the obvious develop first, and then we discover the subtle. But the subtle has created the gross. So even here in this material system, we see first the inner resulting in the outer. Buddhi, the discriminating principle, is at once intelligence and will. It is that power in nature which discriminates and coordinates. We'll see this in the actual terminology in the Gita. Ahankara, the ego sense, is the subjective principle in buddhi, by which the Purusha is induced to identify himself with Prakriti and her activities. So in other words, until it creates a sense of self, Prakriti may be dancing, but Buddhi is not interested until it thinks I am. As soon as it thinks I am, then you are. And then it becomes interested in you. But these subjective principles are themselves as mechanical, as much a part of the inconscient energy as those which constitute her objective operations. If we find it difficult to realize how intelligence and will can be properties of the mechanical inconscient and themselves mechanical, jada, we have only to remember that modern science itself has been driven to the same conclusion. Even in the mechanical action of the atom, there is a power which can only be called an inconscient will, and in all the works of nature, that pervading will does inconsciently the works of intelligence. Sri Aurobindo makes this point in The Life Divine as well, when he's writing his own philosophy, that there is a hidden consciousness, a power of consciousness, in the very lowest substance of nature. It seems to be inconscient, it seems to be blackly unaware of itself. But look at its system of self-organization. It betrays an instinctive consciousness, even if you look at atomic structure. Proton, photon, wherever you go, all the way down to the quantum level, there is something that is working itself out. There is a will embedded at the nature of nature. What we call mental intelligence is precisely the same thing in its essence as that which discriminates and coordinates some consciously in all the activities of the material universe. And conscious mind itself, science has tried to demonstrate, is only a result and transcript of the mechanical action of the inconscient. But Sankhya explains what modern science leaves in obscurity, the process by which the mechanical inconscient takes on the appearance of consciousness. It is because of the reflection of Prakriti in Purusha. The light of consciousness of the soul is attributed to the workings of the mechanical energy, and it is thus that the Purusha, observing nature as the witness and forgetting himself, is deluded with the idea generated in her that it is he who thinks, feels, wills, acts. While all the time, the operation of thinking, feeling, willing, acting is conducted really by her and her three modes and not by himself at all. To get rid of this delusion is the first step towards the liberation of the soul from nature and her works. And what is it you do? You recognize. It is recognition of your core being that frees you from identification with that. It is the act of disidentification. There are certainly plenty of things in our existence which the Sankhya does not explain at all or does not explain satisfactorily. But if all we need is a rational explanation of the cosmic processes and their principles as a basis for the great object common to the ancient philosophies, the liberation of the soul from the obsession of cosmic nature, then the Sankhya explanation of the world and the Sankhya way of liberation seem as good and as effective as any other. And actually, we find that virtually all the rest of Indian philosophy accepts in toto the Sankhya terminology. They criticize, they castigate, they deny its pluralism, its dualism, but they continue to use the terminology of Sankhya. What we do not seize at first is why it should bring in an element of pluralism into its dualism by affirming one Prakriti but many Purushas. Okay. just a little note here. Around somewhere between 600 and 700 CE, there was a work composed called the Yukti Dipika, which was a really good commentary on the Sankhya system as it was developing, in which all these various things were laid out and discussed. What were the original causes, the pramanas? What's the nature of anumana? Let's fix the principles. What number of principles are there in existence? Let's enumerate them. Who are the three gunas, and what is their relationship with Prakriti? That gets defined. And then we have fixed this idea of the plurality of Purushas, that there are a number of Purushas. This was not necessarily an original position in the Sankhya school. We don't see this in the Gita. And remember, that's an aspect of proto-Sankhya. So the philosophy of Sankhya develops several hundred years later in the Karika period, maybe 1,000 years after the Gita. But Sri Aurobindo is going to go ahead and deal with it here, because we have to get through this to get to the other side. Because this is part of what everybody argues about in Sankhya, so Sri Aurobindo is going to deal with it in this chapter, entitled Sankhya and Yoga. So here we go. It would seem that the existence of one Purusha and one Prakriti should be sufficient to account for the creation and procession of the universe. But the Sankhya was bound to evolve pluralism by its rigidly analytical observation of the principles of things. First, actually, we find that there are many conscious beings in the world, and each regards the same world in his own way and has his independent experience of his subjective and objective things, his separate dealings with the same perceptive and reactive processes. Look what he said here. Nature is one. There's one nature. We all experience it, but we all experience nature differently. One Prakriti, but each of us, if we're presumably a Purusha, is different. And how we register, engage our subjective experience differs person to person. If there were only one Purusha, there would not be this central independence and separativeness, but all would see the world in an identical fashion with a common subjectivity and objectivity. Because Prakriti is one, all witness the same world. Because her principles are everywhere the same, the general principles which constitute internal and external experience are the same for all. But the infinite difference of view and outlook and attitude, action and experience, and escape from experience, a difference not of the natural operations which are the same, but of the witnessing consciousness, are utterly inexplicable except on the supposition that there is a multiplicity of witnesses, many Purushas. Well, again, it took several hundred years to fight that out. But that's where Sankhya arrived. The separative ego sense, we may say, is a sufficient explanation. But the ego sense is a common principle of nature and need not vary. It's embedded in the cosmological structure. For by itself, it simply induces the Purusha to identify himself with Prakriti. And if there is only one Purusha, all beings would be one, joined and alike in their egoistic consciousness. However different in detail might be the mere forms and combinations of their natural parts, there would be no difference of soul outlook and soul experience. The variations of nature ought not to make all this central difference, this multiplicity of outlook, and from beginning to end, this separateness of experience in one witness, one Purusha. Therefore, the pluralism of souls is a logical necessity to a pure Sankhya system divorced from the Vedantic elements of the ancient knowledge which first gave it birth. Vedantic, from the Upanishads, which would see all as one. All this is the habitation of the world, of the Lord. Nothing exists outside that. Brahman is above, Brahman is below, Brahman is around, Brahman is within. Oneness is the watchword of the Upanishads, not this duality. So how did we get to this duality? Sri Aurobindo is suggesting the pathway here. Divorced from the Vedantic elements of the ancient knowledge which first gave it birth. We're not sure about that. I mean, that's a historical assertion. We don't have necessarily the evidence to support that. The cosmos and its process can be explained by the commerce of one Prakriti with one Purusha, but not the multiplicity of conscious beings in the cosmos. There is another difficulty quite as formidable. Liberation is the object set before itself by this philosophy as by others. Remember, Sankhya is synonymous with knowledge. And what are we trying to get to with the application of this knowledge, with connection with yoga, except freedom from suffering, immersion in bliss, the essential nature of the soul. This liberation is affected, we have said, by the Purusha's withdrawal of his consent from the activities of Prakriti, which she conducts only for his pleasure. But in sum, this is only a way of speaking. The Purusha is passive, and the act of giving or withdrawing consent cannot really belong to it, but must be a movement in Prakriti itself. You might want to underline that sentence. We can come back and look at that in affiliation with what he writes in the Synthesis of Yoga and what he writes in the Life Divine. We won't go there now. If we consider, we shall see that it is, so far it is, an operation, a movement of reversal or recoil in the principle of buddhi, the discriminative will. Buddhi has been lending itself to the perceptions of the mind sense, manas. It has been busy discriminating and coordinating the operations of the cosmic energy, and by the aid of the ego sense, ahankara, identifying the witness, sakshi, with her works of thought, sense, and action. It arrives by the process of discriminating things at the acid and dissolvent realization that this identity is a delusion. It discriminates finally the Purusha from Prakriti and perceives that all is mere disturbance of the equilibrium of the gunas. The buddhi, at once intelligence and will, recoils from the falsehood which it has been supporting, and the Purusha, ceasing to be bound, no longer associates himself with the interest of the mind in the cosmic play. So it is the buddhi which is critical to this reversal. The ultimate result will be that Prakriti will lose her power to reflect herself in the Purusha, because that is done through buddhi. For the effect of the ego sense is destroyed, and the intelligent will, becoming indifferent, ceases to be the means of her sanction. Necessarily, then, her gunas must fall into a state of equilibrium. the cosmic play must cease. The Purusha returned to his immobile repose. So here is the individual, the Purusha, recognizing the fiction of this material self. From the bottom to the top, I'm not the body, I'm not the life force, I'm not the subtle senses, I'm not the thought, I'm not the amalgamation of all the senses' product, I'm not even the one who sees and thinks and assesses. But if there were only the one Purusha, and this recoil of the discriminating principle from its delusions took place, all cosmos would cease. Ah, here's the point. If Purusha becomes free from Prakriti, and there is only one Purusha, then all apparent Purushas must all become free at the same moment. Ta-da! Universe is over. Prakriti is canceled completely. But that's not what we see. So, there may be one nature in which we all participate, which we all regard, but each Purusha becoming free liberates only that Purusha. There must be many Purushas. Here we go with the rest of this paragraph. As it is, we see that nothing of the kind happens. A few beings among innumerable millions attain to liberation or move towards it. The rest are in no way affected, nor is cosmic nature in her play with them one whit inconvenienced by this summary rejection, which should be the end of all her processes. One among many thousands, never touched, engrossed in the external world's design, etc., etc., from Savitri. Only by the theory of many independent Purushas can this fact be explained. The only at all logical explanation from the point of view of Vedantic monism is that of the Mayavada. But there, the whole thing becomes a dream. Both bondage and liberation are circumstances of the unreality, the empirical blunderings of Maya. In reality, there is none freed, none bound. Advaita Vedanta, Shankara, and his colleagues. The more realistic Sankhya view of things does not admit this phantasmagoric idea of existence and therefore cannot adopt this solution. By the way, Sri Aurobindo is also a realist. He may not agree with Sankhya all the way to the bottom, to the utter separation of Purusha and Prakriti, but he is a realist. There is a reality. There is not ultimately shunya. The void, no, that's an intellectual mistake. An inability to gauge what is beyond the definition of positive being. Asat is not non-existence. Asat is sat escaping its own self-definition. Here too, we see that the multiplicity of souls is an inevitable conclusion from the data of the Sankhya analysis of existence. Before I wear you out, we'll put our bookmark there. I know you've bravely gone through much of India's earliest philosophy. So now we'll turn to Savitri and we'll finish this chapter next week. I think we will start in Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 5, The Godhead's The Little Life. Let's start on page 157. insentient to our eyes that only see the form, the act, and not the imprisoned God. Life hid in her pulse, occult of growth and power, a consciousness with mute, stifled beats of sense, a mind suppressed that knew not yet of thought, an inert spirit that could only be. At first she raised no voice, no motion dared. Charged with world power, instinct with living force, only she clung with her roots to the safe earth, thrilled dumbly to the shocks of ray and breeze, and put out tendril fingers of desire. The strength in her yearning for sun and light felt not the embrace that made her breathe and live. Absorbed, she dreamed content with beauty and hue. At last, the charmed immensity looked forth. Astir, vibrant, hungering, she groped for mind. Then, slowly, sense quivered and thought peered out. She forced the reluctant mold to grow aware. The magic was chiseled of a conscious form, its tranced vibrations rhythmed a quick response, and luminous stirrings prompted brain and nerve, awoke in matter spirit's identity, and in a body lit the miracle of the heart's love and the soul's witness gaze. Impelled by an unseen will, there could break out fragments of some vast impulse to become, and vivid glimpses of a secret self, and the doubtful seeds and force of shapes to be awoke from the inconscient swoon of things. An animal creation crept and ran and flew and called between the earth and sky, hunted by death but hoping still to live and glad to breathe, if only for a while. Then man was molded from the original brute. A thinking mind had come to lift life's moons, the keen-edged tool of a nature mixed and vague, an intelligence half-witness, half-machine. This seeming driver of her wheel of works, missioned to motive and record her drift, and fix its law on her inconstant powers, this master spring of a delicate enginery, aspired to enlighten its user and refine, lifting to a vision of the indwelling power, the absorbed mechanic's crude initiative. He raised his eyes, heaven light mirrored a face. Amazed at the works wrought in her mystic sleep, she looked upon the world that she had made. Wondering now seized the great automaton. She paused to understand herself and aim. Pondering, she learned to act by conscious rule. A visioned measure guided her rhythmic steps. Thought bordered her instincts with a frame of will and lit with the idea her blinded urge. On her mass of impulses, her reflex acts, on the inconscience pushed or guided drift and mystery of unthinking accurate steps, she stuck the specious image of a self, a living idol of disfigured spirit. On matter's acts, she imposed a patterned law. She made a thinking body from chemic cells and molded a being out of a driven force. To be what she was not inflamed her hope. She turned her dream towards some high unknown. A breath was felt below of one supreme. Namaste, Jai Ma.